Genesis chapter 3 we went over last week. And Genesis chapter 3 depicted the fall of man. And then Genesis chapter 4 we just went over last service. And Genesis 4 is the story of Cain and Abel and how Cain killed his brother. From Cain's line, Cain, after he murdered his brother, God sent him away from his family because his family would have obviously probably wanted to take vengeance on him. So Cain went and he kind of started his own civilization. So it says that Cain married someone. A lot of people ask the question, who did Cain marry? Well, it would have had to have been his sister. Back in the day, when Adam and Eve were the only people having birth people, the only people you could obviously hook up with were your siblings. So that's what was happening back in the day. And the way that we think about it in Christianity is if Adam and Eve really were perfect genetically, then incest would not be a problem for their genetics. Does that make sense? So if you have perfect DNA and you have incest, there's not going to be any problems that's going to occur from it. It's only because we're going to read about this today, about the ages of the ancient man and all that. We're going to talk about how humanity is devolving in a lot of ways. We're deteriorating. And so because our genetic code is deteriorating slowly, incest is becoming more and more of a problem. That's why in the book of Leviticus, God outlawed incest. Because at the time of Leviticus, obviously, our genetic code had deteriorated enough that incest would cause problems in your offspring. But at any rate, what we're going to talk about, I'm not going to be reading the whole account. I'm just going to be kind of talking about it, and I'll read a couple verses. But what this is really going to help us understand is it's going to help us understand a couple things. Number one, it's going to help us understand the judgment of God and why he does it. And the second thing we're going to understand is the mercy of God and why he doesn't need to do it, but why it is beautiful. So let's talk about the reasons for the flood. Like I said, Cain started his own line, and the line of Cain becomes wicked. And we don't really know much about them, but there's a couple verses that kind of give us a little insight into what kind of people came from Cain's family. This is verse 19. It says, chapter 4, verse 19. Then Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of one is Ada, and the name of the second was Zillah. And Ada bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the harp and flute. And as for Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor at every craftsman in bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Then Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. Wives of Lamech, listen to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. So what we're seeing here is we're seeing the impacts of sin on how humanity is acting. And just a couple generations after Adam and Eve, what you have is you already have people going against God's plan for marriage. You see polygamy happening. He's marrying two women instead of God's plan for just one. And we see that in Genesis, right? If God's intent was for humanity to just kind of like, you know, hook up with as many people as we could, or to have as many wives as you want, or as husbands as you want, then he would have created that, right? And the Garden of Eden wouldn't have just been one man, one woman. The Garden of Eden would have been a hookup spot, right? God would have created like hundreds of men and women and been like, hey, you know, be fruitful and multiply with whoever. And that would have been how it was. But he only created one man and one woman to show his intent. His intent was always for monogamy, for just one man and one woman to be dedicated together for life. Lamech is obviously going against that. He doesn't care. So he's gotten two wives. A lot of people have used the existence of polygamy in the Old Testament to say that the Bible is for polygamy. I can't remember who said it. It was a Jewish rabbi, though. And he said, anyone who believes that the Bible approves of polygamy doesn't know how to read books made for adults. If you read Genesis, all you see happening from polygamy is you see problem after problem after problem. And we see that God actually didn't design us for that. And the more we use our sexuality, the more we understand it inside of our world, the more we understand that that is exactly how it is. Whenever you see in the Old Testament when someone has a polygamous relationship, you always see a lot of jealousy, you see a lot of hatred, you see a lot of bitterness. Because when you start developing a relationship with someone and you start loving them, like truly loving them, the reason why loving romantic relationships work is because of the specialness of it. Like, I'm special to this person. Right? It's just me and them. They don't look at me the way that they look at other people. And the fact that they choose you, they're like, man, this person chooses me. They could be with other people, but they choose to be with me, and that's amazing. Polygamy or cheating or, you know, just having sex with multiple different people shows whoever your partner is that they're actually not that special. They're just special today. Does that make sense? You're just kind of special to me today, but tomorrow it could be her, or tomorrow you could be with that guy, and that's just the way it is. And it detracts from the specialness, the exclusivity of marriage. And what that does to our hearts is it makes us not want to open up to other people. That's kind of what we've seen happen inside of our generation, the millennials. The millennials are one of the most closed-off generations to ever be in existence. And the reason is because it's so easy to be friends with different people and be in relationships with different people, whether it's through social media or whatever. And so because we have so much transparency inside of our lives, we actually don't have any. Because what we've done is we've created versions of ourselves that we want people to see. But how many people in your life actually know who you really are? I mean, how many people in your life honestly know you? Like, they know what your deepest passions are, your deepest desires are. They know your mistakes, and they love you anyway. They know what things you struggle with. They know your family life and the way that you feel about your parents, the way you feel about... Does that make sense? Like, how many people in your life could you actually point to and be like, yeah, that person knows me? And what we see is that the majority of millennials don't really have anyone that fits that bill. We have a lot of people that know basic things about us, but we have basically nobody who knows the deep things about us. And that makes us feel alone. And that also translates to our romantic relationships. Because we're so afraid of people leaving us or abandoning us, we don't actually open up to people who we're even romantically involved with because we're afraid of them leaving us and abandoning us. So our intimacy is falling further and further apart. We see that happening right here in Genesis chapter 4. It was always happening. The second thing that we notice is we see the violence of man. If you notice in his little song, like he recites it like a song. It really is. It's like a song or a poem. So he wrote like a metal lyric, I guess, right here. And he's like, dude, listen to me. I killed somebody just for wounding me, and a young man for hurting me. The word young man in Hebrew would suggest that this person was probably a teenager. This is like a full-grown adult, like, bragging about murdering a teenager just for, like, I don't know what he did. Maybe, like, he ran over his foot or something like that, but he just straight-up murked this kid for, like, no reason. And he's like proud about it. He's like, dude, like, nobody crosses me. Nobody crosses me and gets away with it. Nobody steps on my feet. Nobody gets in my way. I will kill anybody who even comes close to me. And we see that there's a pride coming from his vengeance. Now, I think men understand this a little bit more than women. Actually, no, I shouldn't say that. Now that I'm thinking about it, women understand this too. Because, you know, as a guy growing up, I used to think as a kid that men were more aggressive than women. And then I went to high school and I saw a chick fight for the first time. And I was like, I was so wrong, man. I was like, so wrong. Like, when I saw like two dudes fight, you know, like they would fight, they would hit each other and like they have a couple bloody noses or whatever. And it was all good. Then I saw two girls fight and they're like clawing at each other's eyeballs. Like, no joke, trying to claw each other's eyes out and like ripping their hair out. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like this is intense. Like, every guy's like, yeah, chick fight, woo. Then you actually see one, you're like, this is awkward. Like, I don't know what to do about this. This is like intense. Like, should I call 911? Like, you like, I think they're going to kill each other. Like, it's intense. But the reason why we do that, I realize this growing up, is because there's an insecurity in who we are, and there's a fear in who we are, that we're afraid that people are going to take advantage of us. And you're like, dude, if I let this guy get away with talking like that to me, then what's going to happen in the future? Does that make sense? So my aggression, the reason why I'm so aggressive, the reason why I'm so violent in response to things, is actually because of fear. I'm in a way, I'm afraid of my own security as a man, and I'm also afraid of what's going to happen to me in the future if I don't respond in that way. When I was in the Marines, I definitely saw that, because the Marine Corps is like obviously a very aggressive culture, and you don't let anyone get away with anything in the Marines. Like, if someone even looks at you funky, like, there's got to be a fight. There's got to be something happening as a result of that. And that's just kind of the way that guys are. But like I said, thinking about it, I think that guys are actually a little more civilized than girls. Because, again, with guys, usually after the fight, things kind of were okay. You know, like, you know, even if you're like, dude, I freaking hate that guy, you never talk to him again, whatever. But the fight was it. Like, that's as violent as it got. for girls, it's like the fight is just the beginning. You know, like there's the fight, and then there's like the gossip and the slandering of each other's like whole livelihoods, and like then girls are vicious, man. I don't even know what to say about that. But do you see that the viciousness and the aggressiveness is a result of insecurity and pride, and we see it's running rampant in the creation. And what God's faced with, so what we're really talking about today is we're talking about God's justice. And we all hopefully know the story, that God decides to flood the earth and kill everybody on the planet except for Noah. And that's pretty hardcore, you know, when you think about it. That's probably millions of people that he's just wiping out. That's worse than any world war we've ever had. You know, like that's just, he's just like, dude, I'm just going to kill the earth. And that was what he did. And the question that we could ask ourselves is God just? Is God just in doing this? And I'm going to give you guys a philosophical kind of primer. Those of you guys who aren't into philosophy, it's going to go right over your head and you're going to forget it immediately. Those of you guys who kind of like philosophy, you'll kind of grab this. But there's two basic principles to any form of justice system. There's one, it's called retributive justice, and the second one is called consequential justice. And if you guys ever take like a philosophy 101 class, you'll talk about this. Retributive justice is justice based on deserving. So what that means is that I'm gonna exercise justice on this person because they deserve it. They did something wrong, and so they deserve to be punished. Consequential justice thinks more big picture. They think, what justice should we administer to help the world as a whole? Does that make sense? So retributive justice, if I steal like an apple from someone's shop, all retributive justice thinks is that person deserves to suffer because they stole. Consequential justice would look at it and say, if I don't punish this person, then other people will steal and it will lead to worse things in society. Do you guys understand that? Now, there are problems with both. If I go hardcore retributive justice, and if you guys want to know a comic book character who like fulfills this to a T, it's Rorschach from The Watchmen. If you guys ever watched The Watchmen, it's like, dude, Rorschach from The Watchmen is definitely the best part of that comic. It's from DC Comics, and Rorschach is just hardcore, man. Like, his lines are just so great. Like, at one point, he's in prison, and the prisoner's trying to pick on him, and he, like, dumps grease on this guy and kills him. And he's just like, you guys think that I'm trapped here with you? He's like, you're trapped here with me. And he's just like, this is a hardcore dude. And he's like, this is a hardcore, just like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. People deserve to get justice. It doesn't matter what happens to society. It doesn't matter anything else. It just matters that people get justice for what they've done. And at the end of the movie, the reason why he's, spoiler alert, the reason why he's killed is because he's faced with a dilemma, where he realizes that by giving someone justice for what they deserve, he would end up killing millions of people. So somebody is guilty of basically genocide, and he realizes by giving this person justice and exposing them, I would actually be killing millions of people. But because he's so hardcore into retribution, he's like, I don't care. Dude, this guy's getting justice. I don't care who suffers. This is what's right. And so he just can't see anything other than the small print. Does that make sense? The problem with consequential justice is it completely, and this is where our society is, by the way, it completely gets rid of the idea of someone deserving something. So you go to prison now, and you go to prison, and it's not so much about, you know, like making it up to the people that you hurt or anything like that. It's just like, we're going to fix you. We're going to fix you. You're going to go to prison. We're going to give you classes about anger management and getting off of drugs and stuff like that. And we're going to fix you. And it completely misses the point of like whether or not someone deserves it or not. And this is the problem that we get into. Number one, it's completely useless when it comes to the victims. Meaning if someone robs me today, the government's not like, you know what? This person should pay you back because they robbed you. They're like, no, we need to fix his larceny problem, you know? And I'm like, well, that's great that you're fixing him, but who's going to fix what I lost, man? Like, who's going to pay me back for what I lost? That's awesome, but I mean, who's going to help me out? Or if someone, you know, drives drunk or something like that and like, you know, runs into me and kills my wife, they'd be like, you know, we need to fix this person's drinking problem. Well, that's great, but this person killed someone. Like, there needs to be justice for that. There needs to be some sort of a consequence for that. And the question comes up of like, what if that person doesn't want to be fixed? What if that person doesn't want to be fixed? Because you've thrown out justice so much and you're not even thinking about it anymore, it doesn't matter. This person may not be fixed, and I don't get made whole either. So no one gets what they want. But what we see in the Bible is God has both perspectives of justice in mind. He judges people because they deserve it, but he also judges people to help future generations. So when he's looking at mankind, he's saying, I need to flood mankind. We shouldn't look at God and say, like, well, that's not right. Well, first of all, he's just to do it because these people deserve it. So you could say all you want, well, that's not right. But the fact of the matter is that God created the heavens and the earth. So there is no justice that exists besides him. So he could do what he wants. That's the first part. But the second part, and this helps us kind of get a more greater understanding of God and why he does things, is we see that God actually is doing this to preserve future generations. So what he realizes is at the time of the flood, he realized the only righteous family on earth at the time of the flood was Noah. And he says, if I allow human history to keep going, everyone righteous will be gone. And all that will be left is unrighteousness. Yes. Yes. Yeah. And so we see that here, but when I read Genesis 6, we'll talk a little bit more about what they were doing. But yeah, they were pretty bad. So, and they completely rejected God. So in God's perspective, see, he sees the big picture. We see the little picture. And so we just look and we say, like, that was wrong for God to do. But God looks at the big picture and says, like, well, what's better? You know, that I kill a million people today or that billions of people have to die tomorrow? Right? And so God makes the impossible decisions that you and I couldn't make. There's another good movie called Swordfish. I can't recommend you guys watch either of the movies I've mentioned, by the way, because they're both rated R. And anyway, but they're good movies. And in the movie Swordfish, there's this question, right? And John Travolta and Hugh Jackman are having a conversation at the end. I love it. Their dialogue is amazing. Because, like, John Travolta has this idea of, like, we have to make tough decisions to preserve humanity as a whole. And Hugh Jackman says, we don't have the right to make those decisions. And so John Travolta asks him a question. He says, what if you could cure every disease on earth today, but you had to kill one innocent child? Would you do it? And Hugh Jackman's like, no, I couldn't do that. I was like, that's not just. He's like, so you'd allow millions of people to die for generations just because you can't slaughter one innocent kid? And he's like, and you could see Hugh Jackman, like, wrestling with it. He's like, no, it's not right. And he's like, but what, you know, and how many innocent children are killed by diseases, though? Right? So by killing one, you'd be saved. So we as human beings, we can't make those decisions. Why? Because we don't see the big picture. We don't actually know that that's going to happen. The reason why God is able to make those decisions, because guess what? He does see the big picture. He does see the consequences of every action that he would make. And he knows which ones are correct. So that's a little, just, I wanted to give you guys a little brief kind of understanding of justice and why it exists and why God does it. But the basic thing that we understand as Christians is, God sees the end from the beginning, and we have to just submit and trust that his justice is correct. Because I don't see the big picture, I'm always going to question the justice of God. But I have to trust that he's doing the right thing, because he knows the whole story. I don't. I only see a very small picture. He sees the whole thing. The next thing I want to bring out is the existence of righteousness. So after Cain killed Abel, Adam and Eve gave birth to another son named Seth. And Seth began to pursue God, and actually a lot of his offspring were pursuing God as well. And this is where we get the story of Enoch. I'm not going to read it, but Enoch is an interesting guy. He lived for like 300 years, and then God just took him up into heaven. So we see that a lot of the offspring of Seth were very godly, and they were pursuing God. But you see that their influence in the world is starting to dwindle. And we'll talk more about why that happened when we get to chapter 6. But I just wanted to point out the fact that there was righteousness. It was just getting stomped out because of the overwhelming influence of Cain. Another thing that I want to point out really quickly, if you guys read these chapters, which you can, the Bible has these things in it called genealogies. And it will be long lists of names and people and who they give birth to and all this stuff. And if you're ever reading the Bible, don't think you have to read those. Because when you read them, you're just going to be like, I can't pronounce half these names, and I'm totally lost. And you're going to forget what you're reading, and it's not going to help you. So just, if you ever see a genealogy, this is what I'm saying, as your pastor, just skip them, right? Sometimes some pastors can put them in perspective that could actually help you. But for the most part, the reason why we have genealogies in the Bible is to preserve the line from Adam to Jesus. Do you guys understand that? The reason why they're in there is so that we can account for where Jesus came from to prove, first of all, that he came from man and thus he's righteous to redeem man, and secondly, that he came from Isaac and thus he is from the tribe of Israel. That's really the only reason why the genealogies are in there. It's just for that purpose. That's why we don't keep them anymore. You know, the New Testament, guess what? You don't see any genealogies being preserved anymore because we don't need it. It was just so that we could preserve the genealogy of the Messiah, and now it's done. But one thing I want to point out in the genealogies is this. The people are living to like 900 years old. And there's been a lot of debate of like, you know, does the Bible really mean 900 years old? Maybe like they considered time different than us, and so it's not actually 900 years. And there's a lot of debate. But I think the clearest understanding of this is that people really did live to be 900 years old. How is this possible? Like I said, you're dealing with almost perfect DNA, and you're dealing with a planet that is not like the planet is today. We'll talk more about this when we get to the flood, but it's very clear from the description of the planet in Genesis 5 and 6 that the earth that you're dealing with in Genesis 5 and 6 is much different than the earth that we're dealing with today. Something happened in the flood to alter the atmosphere and to alter the way the earth is as a whole. And whatever happened also led to us having a higher mortality rate. We die a lot quicker than that. But honestly, when I read these things, I believe that God shortening the lifespan of man was a mercy to us. I think it was a very merciful thing that God did. Here's why I say that. If you are a person and you are following God and you're pursuing God, every day that you live on this earth will bring you closer to Him and it will be more and more enjoyable. If you're a person going against God, every day on this earth will lead you further from Him and lead you closer and closer to hell. Living for 120 years in your sinful life, you could ignore a lot of the faults inside of you and you could be relatively okay. Living for 900 years with faults is going to make you as close to a demon as anyone has ever seen. I don't know if you guys have hung around old people a lot. When you hang around old people, it really is, there's no middle ground. You're either going to hang out with someone who's like a saint or someone who's like the freaking devil. And you're like, this person is terrible. You look at him and be like, you know, you have like your alcoholic grandpa and he's like the worst human being on the face of the earth. And you're like, dude, how could you function as a human being? You're such a jerk, dude. Like, you don't care about your kids. You don't care about your family. You just feed your stuff. And like, and they're so sinful. Like my grandpa, when he was dying, he lived on a diet of rum, raisin, ice cream and whiskey. And it's like, and the doctor said, like, dude, you have type 2 diabetes. You're going to die. And he was so in his sin. He's like, I don't care. And he's like throwing it back. I don't care. I'm going to die anyway. I don't give a rip, you know, because he had just fed his sin for so long. He was just like the worst human being on the planet. And he just died, you know, and that's it. He didn't reach out to his family or anything. Imagine someone like that. Just picture this person in your head, this old person in your head who's like a jerk today. Expand their life 800 years. They would be horrific. They would be the worst person in the face of the earth. They would be so bad that you'd be like, this guy's got to die. You know, like there's no way someone like that could live that long and not just ruin everyone's lives around them. So it definitely was a mercy that God started to take away a lot of our lifespans for sure. But there's physical reasons for it as well. Now let's talk a little bit more about what exactly they were doing. This comes from chapter 6, verse 1. It says, now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, the daughters were born to them, and that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, and they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, they bore children to them. Those were mighty men of old, who were of old and men of renown. Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Couple things to point out about this section. Number one, what's going on in the first couple verses? A lot of people, when you read that, you immediately think like God of War, you know, like, dude, there's like angels having sex with humans and it's creating like this hybrid race of angel demon things, and they're running around and then maybe they got like wings and they're killing people, and I don't know, maybe you guys are thinking like Underworld, I don't know. But anyway, a lot of people like debate about what these people were, that are these sons of God that are having sex with these daughters of men. Some have theorized, like I said, that these are the sons of God are angels. And they began to have sex with female women, and that created a weird angel hybrid race. And so God created the flood to destroy them. There's a couple problems with this theory. Number one is it's never explicitly said that these people are angels. There are some passages in the Bible that might allude to it. But the number one problem that we have is when you get into the book of Deuteronomy and Joshua, when the people go into the land, they claim that they see Nephilim. Nephilim are the names given to these, whatever, these daughters of men and sons of God. They're called Nephilim or giants. The flood was supposed to wipe them all out. Yet, in Deuteronomy and Joshua, they see Nephilim. They're like, these guys are Nephilim. So if God wiped all of them out in the flood, who are these guys in Deuteronomy and Joshua? And that provides us with quite a problem with people with that theory of the angel hybrid theory. I don't see anything theologically wrong with that theory, meaning I'm not like adamantly opposed to it. There are some passages in Jude and 2 Peter that seem to allude that this is what was going on. But once again, I just don't know. So it's one of those things where it's like I'll wait for further information. The second theory is that these sons of men, these sons of God, were the faithful sons of Seth, and the daughters of men were the evil daughters of Cain. And they started to co-marry. The reason why I tend to believe that one more is because what God says in verse 5. He doesn't say, and the Lord saw the wickedness of half-men angel hybrids, and he realized he needed to wipe them out. That's not what he says. He says he saw the wickedness of man, and that every intent and thoughts of his heart were only evil continually. Because the question is what happened? If these are just angels having sex with women, what happened to the righteous line of Seth? What happened to these guys? And this would answer it. If this is true, that means what happened to them is they started to have intimacy with wicked women, and those wicked women brought them away from God, and so their lines became destroyed. And that's what happened. Noah was the only one who stayed true to what he was supposed to do. And that's why I tend to believe this theory a little bit more. I don't know for a fact, I just tend to believe it more. What we get from this is that Satan doesn't always have to destroy you in order to get you away from God. Satan can use romance to do so. And we don't really... It's definitely one of the greatest challenges in the church today. It's hardcore. We're like these faithful men and women who are like following God get lonely, and they meet someone who's awesome and attractive, and they're like, this person's amazing. They're just not Christians. But is that really a big deal, you know? Because, you know, you hang out in church, and you're like, man, you know, you girls are like, dude, all the guys in church are nerds. And then the guys are like, dude, all the girls in church, they're all prudes, and I don't know. And you're just like, this girl is so awesome, and I can just hang out with her and have fun. And is it really that bad that I like this girl and she likes me? Is that really wrong? Yes, it is. It is. And this is the reason. The Bible puts it this way. It says, don't be unequally yoked with a non-believer. It means if my heart and soul is like, I want to pursue and follow God, and I'm marrying someone who doesn't want to pursue and follow God, do you think that that might lead to some disagreements in our marriage? Especially when we have kids. It's like, what are we going to do? Right? My wife's an atheist and I'm a Christian. What should we do with our kids? My wife would be like, should we teach them fairy tales? I'd be like, no. You know, and like, then we'll get into a fight and disagreement. And then our kids are going to grow and be like, do I side with my mom or do I side with my dad? You know, who do I follow? Who do I listen to? And it's going to cause disagreement. It's going to cause dissension. It's going to cause me to backslide as a Christian, because the more I hang out with this person that I care for, the more I care about their opinion. And if I care about my wife's opinion of me so much, and a lot of my identity is rooted in what she thinks of me, and she's an atheist, in order to get her respect, I need to fall further away from God. And so it's going to impact me as a Christian. And it's most of the time, it's not going to work out for her betterment. And we see this happening. God says, dude, every intent and thought of their heart is evil continually. These people are wicked. They're doing horrible things. They're committing polygamy. They're destroying my planet. Everything's being killed as a result of these men. And so he says, the only way to preserve, in a weird way, God's saying, the only way for me to preserve man is to wipe out man. The only way for me to preserve anything on this planet is to wipe out what's going on right now. And so he chooses to get the flood. Now, it's never specifically said in the Bible, but we do see little hints that God's decision to do this was for the betterment of mankind. If God was just pissed off at man, he could have done a lot of different things. He could have caused like AIDS to like spread and just kill everybody off. There's a lot of different ways that God could have done this. But he chooses to do a flood, which is interesting. And he chooses to save one particular family, which is also interesting. Keep in mind that last part of verse 8 where it says Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Just keep that in the back of your heads and let's move on real quick because I do want to finish. Now, from chapter 6, the end of chapter 6 through the end, what happens is God picks Noah and he says, you're going to build my ark and I'm going to preserve you. And the question a lot of people ask is like, well, how long did it take Noah to build the ark? You know, because if you read the dimensions, they're pretty insane. In fact, there's a church in San Diego called The Rock. And The Rock Church has the exact dimensions of the ark. And when I walked into The Rock Church, it just like, just getting that visual like blew me away. Because like, I always had the picture of Sunday school where, you know, you got Noah and he's like in the ark. He's in like the top part of the ark and there's like an elephant head like peeking out. And like, it looks just like a little toy boat or something. It's like this tiny little thing. Walking into the Rock Church, I was like, oh my gosh, that thing is humongous. First of all, it was like 50 feet high. So it was seriously 50 feet high. It was taller than the Tucson Mall. It was unbelievably huge. And then it was weird because it like wasn't that wide. You'd like look and it was only like, it was maybe like 50 yards wide. So it wasn't, it didn't look that big. But then lengthwise, it was humongous. Like you could seriously have a football game in that church. It was so long. It was humongous. So like, get that Sunday school idea out of your head. Yeah, here's a picture of it. This is pretty cool. Yeah, comparison to other boats. And you see, the Titanic is right here. So it's just a little bit smaller than the Titanic, which is pretty crazy. But, yeah, dude. So, 500 feet long. And it was a massive boat. It was just ridiculously massive. And so the question is, like, how long did Noah have to build this thing? Well, actually, the Bible tells us. God says, my spirit will not strive with men forever, so his days will be shortened to 120 years. And a lot of people, when they read that, they think that God has limited man's lifespan to 120 years. But that's just not true. Noah lives longer than 120 years. And in fact, Abraham lives 200 years. So we know that's not true. And a lot of people in science are like, all we have to do to disprove the Bible is have someone live past 120. No, if that happens, that's whatever. That's not, people in the Bible live past 120. There's nothing inconsistent about that. God's saying, in 120 years, I'm going to send the flood. So that's how long Noah had to build this thing. He had 120 years to build this thing, which is quite a long time. It's quite a long task to do it. But so a lot of people are like, dude, there's no way Noah could have done it. You know, he was alone. 120, I think he could have done it. You know, like, I'm not an expert carpenter, but what's that? Yeah, and he had his family helping him. So there's a lot of evidence that, yeah, he absolutely could have done it. He had enough time and God gave him the dimensions. So it's pretty radical. And then you got chapter 7 through 8, describe the flood. And here's a question I got for you guys. Should we believe that the flood was an actual occurrence? Or is this like an analogy or a metaphor or something like that? I believe that we absolutely should believe that the flood was an actual occurrence. And this is why. Number one, the Bible is not speaking allegorically here. This is historical. The Bible is speaking as if it's a history. But the second thing is that in order to ignore the flood, the reason why people ignore the flood today is not because of a theological problem with it. The reason why they ignore the flood today is actually because of a scientific problem with it. If you believe in a global flood, you have to believe in young earth creationism. And the reason why is because the flood explains so many of the geological phenomena that are around the earth that could only otherwise be explained through billions and billions of years. It explains the fossil record. It explains the Precambrian explosion. It explains the Grand Canyon. It explains the mountain ranges and why they are the height that they are. It explains the continental drift. It explains everything with the flood. Because it doesn't just say, and then God caused rain to happen for a while, and then it flooded. That's not what it says. It says that God opens up the fountain of the deep. So whatever's happening here in Genesis is a great tectonic event. God is like splitting continents and allowing water to flow, and he's building a mountain, and he's doing like these hardcore things. And so the only way to disagree with the flood is say the earth is old. I don't have time to get into it right now, but the evidence surrounding the flood is actually pretty substantial when you look at the fossil record in this light. A lot of people have said that the Grand Canyon is one of the greatest evidences of old earth creationism, old earth evolution. Recently in the 80s, a volcano called Mount St. Helens erupted. And when Mount St. Helens erupted, I really encourage you guys to look it up on your own time. There's a book that was released by one of the geologists who studied it called Footprints in the Ash. It's a great book. I read it, and I did a presentation on it in college geology class, and I got an A. So it was really cool. And this dude's a Christian, so I did a presentation on his book, and they all agreed with it. The things that they found happen in Mount St. Helens showed this idea of what we call catastrophism. It means that if I take the Earth and I say, if things progress normally without any changes, yes, the Earth would take billions of years to get to the way it is today. But if I say that the Earth's geology and fossil layer stuff occurred because of catastrophic events in our history, then I have to change my theory up a little bit. What we see happening in Mount St. Helens is in one day, just from a lake emptying out beneath Mount St. Helens, in one day, a mini Grand Canyon was formed. Just one day. It's 1/40th to scale the size of the Grand Canyon. It was formed in one day. In one day, because of the sediment that fell out from this eruption, a 90-foot wall was built in one day, just with sediment laying on top of one another. And you see pictures of it. It's amazing. They also say that like the development of coal and stuff must have taken thousands of years. Just since the 1980s, the ash and stuff and the trees that fell inside of the lake, they've already developed into peat, which is the first step to becoming coal. And they've said that peat should take hundreds of thousands of years to form. It's taken less than 20. So this catastrophic event has shown us that the Earth doesn't need billions of years to look the way that it does, but it does need catastrophic events to happen the way it does. But in order to agree with this catastrophic event, I have to agree that Genesis was right, and that's offensive to people, so they will never do that. So they can't say it. Another thing that happened was, this is actually a really funny story. The guy who did it, I can't remember his name, it was Shelby, but the dude was awesome. I actually emailed him while I was doing my report, and he got back to me. He was like, yeah, dude, this sounds awesome. And he like helped me out, and he helped me do a report. It was really cool. And he said that what happened was, in geology, you learn about this type of rock. It's called igneous rock, and it's formed from volcanoes and stuff like that. And in my textbook, it said that igneous rock takes a minimum of 2 million years to form. They found igneous rock form within the first year, and they sent it to be carbon dated at a lab. And when the lab brought it back, they said it was 2 million years old. And they're like, dude, we literally watched this form. We saw it form, like with our own two eyes. Yeah. It was from Mount St. Helens. So they sent it. And so you see that the carbon dating is a little bit biased because they're getting something that their presupposition already states, this must be 2 million years old. So no matter what results they're going to get back from dating it, they're always going to say 2 million years old because that's what they've already stated in their heads. Does that make sense? So there's a lot of interesting things to believe. I just want to throw that out for you guys so that you guys can, you know, maybe study it a little on your own and think through it. A great site to go to read about this is answersingenesis.com. It's great. But I did mention last week that you can be a Christian and believe in billions and billions of years. There's nothing wrong with that. And the Christians that believe in billions and billions of years, they think that it was a flood in an area. So humanity was only in one spot at this time, and that area got wiped out. I disagree with them, but But like I said, I think that they are brothers in Christ. I think they are Christians. And if you ever want to listen to it, Hugh Ross is a great apologist, and he's got a good talk, and he believes in old earth. So he's got a good talk on Noah's Ark, and it's interesting. I listen to it. It's interesting. I don't agree with it, but I think it's interesting, and I understand his reasoning. But at any rate, let's move on really quickly. In chapter 9, God is now... So you guys all know the story, right? They're floating in the boat, and then they ended up on a mountain. And then God sends a wind, which is, by the way, what we as Christians believe caused the ice age. Because if you have a ton of water over all the earth, and the earth's in upheaval, like what the Bible's saying, and then God sends a giant wind over it, it's kind of like if it rains all day today, and then all of a sudden the wind starts blowing, the temperature's going to drop quite a bit. So God sends this giant wind, and it's probably going to cool down the earth like a ton. And so that's what we believe the ice age happened, was around this time. But at any rate, God sends this wind. It takes away that water. Man leaves the boat, right? They come down, they start setting things up, and then God makes a covenant with mankind. I don't have time to go into it because we're almost out of time. One thing I'll mention about a covenant. Covenant is just a promise between two people. It's like a commitment that two people make with one another. That's all that word means. It was absolutely unheard of for God to make a covenant with mankind in any other ancient religion. Because what a covenant states is it states, you and me are entering into agreement which neither of us will break. And there will be consequences if either one of us break it. The gods of the ancient people, they would never do that with man. They'd be like, I'll tell you what, you do what I say or else I'll crush you. I'm not gonna make an agreement with you. Are you kidding? I'm God. You know, like they never did that. God humbles himself and makes a covenant with man and says, I am no longer going to wipe out the earth with a flood. And you guys remember what agreement he gave us? It's the rainbow, right? Now it's not saying that it never says that God then created the rainbow. They had never seen a rainbow before, and then God made refracted light. That's not what it says. God says the rainbow will now forever be a symbol between us. Do you guys understand that? So the Bible at no point, so whenever people are like, this is how we got the rainbow, that's not what this is about, all right? It's not like up until this point, light never refracted through moisture, and now God just created it. That's not what it's saying. It's saying that God's saying every time it rains, when you see it, you're just reminded of this promise I made with you. It had already been happening, but God's just saying, but now it means something different. Now, the interesting thing about the rainbow, why we call it a rainbow, the word in Hebrew that God uses, he doesn't use the word rainbow. I hope you guys know that. Like, he's not like, if you see the rainbow, you know, like he doesn't say that. The word he uses in Hebrew is actually, it's a word that refers to a warrior's bow, like an archer's bow. And what God is saying, if you guys get the symbolism here, he's saying, whenever you look at the rainbow, that's my bow. That's my wrath towards man, and I've laid it up. Like, I'm not going to use it anymore. And there's something really interesting about the rainbows. You notice, if it really is like an archer's bow, you'll notice that it's upside down. You'll look at it and be like, it's aimed up. It's not aimed down anymore. And what God is saying with this symbol is he's saying there is still wrath against mankind. Remember, God has not ceased to be retributive in his justice. He's not saying, hey, my justice is done. I'm not going to do it anymore. At the end of the covenant, he says, I'm not going to do this anymore, even though you guys are wicked and you guys are going to continue to be wicked. What he's saying is there's still wrath, but now the wrath is not aimed down anymore. It's aimed which way? It's aimed up. He says there's going to be wrath poured out, and it's going to be poured out on me. And so God takes our punishment, he takes our sin, the flood hits Jesus and crucifies him. And that is why we have salvation. That is why we have any standing before God. One last thing I want to bring up before we wrap up. Okay, so the flood demonstrates the cross to us. It shows us the cross in the Old Testament, where Noah represents Christ. The one faithful man saves all of humanity through his suffering. Right, Jesus, the one faithful man, through his suffering, he saves all of mankind. But man can never fully satisfy the wrath of God. And what we see at the end of chapter 9 is we see Noah fail. Noah decides, you know what, this is cool. And he starts growing grapes, and he's like, man, these grapes are awesome. And then he leaves it out for a while, and he's like, man, they start smelling kind of good. And he's like, and then he like starts drinking them, and he's like, man, this is awesome. He starts getting wasted every night. And he starts getting wasted, and he ends up streaking at one point. I'm not making this up. Like, he starts getting wasted, he starts streaking, and he passes out naked in his tent. And his son comes in, his son Ham. He's like, you know, dad's naked. And like he gets his brothers. He's like, hey, dude, like dad's naked. He's passed out. Isn't that hilarious? And his brothers are like, dude, no. And so they go and they cover their dad and they show that they respect and they revere their father. One thing that we get from other than Noah's failure, which I'm going to talk about in a second, the Bible has an interesting view of nakedness. That the Bible has a view of nakedness, that nakedness is special. You guys get that? That like when the son went in and he saw the nakedness of his father, it was disrespectful that he saw his dad's nakedness. And whenever in Leviticus, when it talks about having sex with someone that you're not supposed to have sex with, it always refers to it this way, uncovering their nakedness. And so the Bible has this idea for us that your nakedness is actually special and it's only meant to be shared with a specific person. Does that make sense? Does our culture view it that way? No, nudity is not very special. You know, like nudity is like, yeah, I could go anywhere and see nudity. You know, it's all over the place. You know, it's not special at all. But the Bible says, no, it's very special. It's meant to be kept sacred. You know, that nakedness is meant to be kept sacred. When it comes to the idea of the actually opening yourself up to someone in the vulnerability. Obviously, I'm not saying that it's bad to go in the locker room at school, but you know, I'm saying that like there's a specific context for this type of nakedness that should only be experienced between two people. But the thing that Noah's failure most demonstrates to me as someone who fails is it demonstrates to me the type of person God uses. Noah was the first person God used in this fallen creation. And Noah sucked, right? So the Bible, like when you read the Bible, a lot of people are like, dude, the Bible's just a bunch of myths and legends about, you know, like heroes and stuff. And you can see that anywhere. And I'm like, dude, have you read it? You know, like, because I've read a lot of ancient mythology. And whenever you read ancient mythology, it is about heroes. You know, you have people who are like awesome and they never do anything wrong and they're always amazing and their whole lives are about honor and virtue and awesomeness. And even if they do make mistakes, they always learn from their mistakes. Noah never learns from his mistake. He never goes in front of his kids and is like, hey kids, you know what? I should be a better example. I shouldn't have gotten drunk. You know, and the fact that I was naked, yeah, Ham, that was wrong if you'd make fun of me, but dude, at the end of the day, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't put myself in this situation. You know what he does? He goes up to Ham. He's like, Ham, you suck. And he's like, because of that, he's like, you see your kid? He's going to suck. And he like curses his kid. And you're like, dude, he doesn't learn his lesson. Like, he doesn't learn his lesson at all. He doesn't say anything about like what he did. And it's like so horrible. And that's our hero, the Bible. That's our shining example of who to follow is Noah. Gets wasted at the end of his life and blames his kids for it. You know, like you're like, dude, what's that? He didn't die in the ark. This is when they're hanging out down there. He dies of old age, or maybe he gets drunk and kills. I don't know, but like, it just says he dies at like 900 or something. But what we see is that in the Bible, God uses people who are a wreck, because the Bible is God's story. It's not man's. Does that make sense to you guys? The Bible is not about man reaching God. The Bible is always about God reaching down to man who doesn't deserve it. That's why Jesus had to be the savior of mankind. It had to have been God. It's God's story. And the reason why I believe God could use me is not because I'm a good person. It's because I look at this story and I'm like, wow, God could use literally anybody. You remember what I said, the reason why God chose Noah? You remember what the words were? Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. It doesn't say, and Noah was super awesome. So God's like, I'm going to spare you because how could I kill you, Noah? Like, you're amazing. Like, dude, how could I possibly wipe you? I can't even imagine wiping you out. You're just too perfect. He's like, dude, you know what? I'm having mercy on you. Right? Noah was more righteous than his neighbors, for sure. But that doesn't mean he was perfect. Right? He was still a mess, just like the rest of us. So that's just a little encouragement to us. God can use anyone, and that's what the flood tells us. And he does use anyone, because it's about his glory, not about ours. So let's pray, and then if you guys have any questions, you could ask me. Dear God, I want to thank you so much for your word that you do use just people who are a mess, Lord. I thank you that you use me, and I thank you that you will continue to use all of us, Lord, in various ways and various times in our lives. We love you so much, and we thank you for your cross, that you took the punishment we deserve. Help us to remember that. Help us to be thankful for it. And in your name, amen.